So, let us see what we've got here. As Abraham said something about giving a very hard question, so I'm not sure about this. So see what's going on. Okay, dear Bhante Brahmali, sometimes retreatants covered their eyes during meditation. Is it so that the nimitta light effect will be better? Thank you very much. I think the main reason why people cover their eyes is simply to shut out any kind of sensory impact at all. The idea simply is to, you know, avoid hearing anything, avoid seeing anything. And the more you can shut out the senses, the easier it is to become peaceful. But usually it's plenty enough to actually close your eyes and do your meditation with closed eyes. Usually that's plenty enough. And after a while, if your meditation gets deep, your senses tend to shut off anyway. They shut off. That's the real shutting off. When they shut off inside of you, when they shut off inside of you, and you cannot see, it doesn't matter whether you have a covering or whatever, because there's no more seeing regardless at that point. That is the kind of real kind of covering your eyes, when you cannot see because your meditation is so deep. So if you find it useful, you can cover your eyes. If you find it useful, you can plug your ears and all these kind of things. And some people do that. But often it's not really required, because if you are peaceful and you are quiet and you meditate, it will go well regardless usually. But it's up to you, and whatever works is basically the way to go. Okay, next one. Okay, dear Ajahn, nice meeting you again in this retreat. that's very nice. I remember you did the closing speech last retreat, and I remember it was one of the best talk and admire I ever received. Okay, thank you. You mentioned about integrating the spiritual life into our daily personal life and see how well we do in our next retreat. The answer, yes, it works. Thanks. My meditation gets better. Thank you, and Ajahn Brahm. Well, that's a very nice one. Very easy to answer. okay, good. I'm very glad that it works. It works for me as well, so it's two of us at least. That's great. Okay, dear Ajahn, I understand that printing Dharma books in memory of deceased can dedicate merit to them. But what if they have been reborn? Okay. This is one of the things that you actually find in the suttas. The Buddha makes it very clear who you can dedicate merit to and who you can't. And the Buddha basically says that there are certain classes of beings, and these are the beings in the ghost realms, and these are the beings who are able to receive whatever merit you dedicate to them. And there is an interesting sutta from the Anguttara Nikaya, and there is a Brahmin. He goes up to the Buddha and says to him, well, what if I don't have any relatives in this particular ghost realm? And the Buddha says, well, you've been wandering around in samsara for so long, for so many lifetimes, for so many eons, basically, that it is impossible. It's absolutely inconceivable that you should have no relatives in that ghost realm. You can be absolutely sure there's going to be somebody there. And so this is always a beautiful thing to do. You do something nice, and somebody out there will be able to receive the benefits of that offering. They will rejoice in what you're doing. They will feel a sense of happiness because you're remembering them, remembering your parents, your relatives, or whoever it actually is. It's always a nice thing to do. And printing Dharma books, the reason why printing Dharma books is considered good merit is because you find in the suttas, the Buddha always said that the highest kind of generosity, the highest gift you can give, is the gift of the Dhamma. So if you print a good Dhamma book, make sure it is not just some dodgy Dhamma book, it actually really is a good one, then, because sometimes you get things which are a bit strange, not really all that good Dhamma. So make sure it's good Dhamma. And if you print that and you distribute that to other people so they can grow in the happiness, they can reduce their suffering in life, then you're providing a very good service in the world. Okay, next one here. Passa is said to be established by the corresponding engagement. Is this corresponding engagement the same as Kama Chanda that keeps us drawn to the Kama Guna? If so, how can it be allowed to fade? Okay. Now then, Passa is said to be established. Passa is a universal mental state. It's something that everybody has. If you're an arahant, you still have passa. The word passa means contact. And contact in this case means that you get an impression either through the eye, through the ear, through bodily touch or whatever. And it's the way that we are able to experience the world around us. That's what passa means. You're contacting the world, so to speak. And that contact happens through the five senses. And these five senses, whether you are fully enlightened or you are just an ordinary putujana or you are a stream mentor, whatever you are, you're going to have this kind of passa. That's just basically what it is. Now, kamachanda literally means the desire that you have. Kamachanda is something we add on top of passa. So you have passa, you have contact, but then because of your defilements, you actually desire those things in the five senses. And that's what kamachanda is. These are two different things. Passa you have to have, kamachanda you don't have to have. It's something we add on top of that. So the way that you allow kamachanda to fade, of course, is by practicing this path, but eventually becoming a stream mentor, seeing the Dhamma, and then eventually by continuing that path, kamachanda disappears, but passa is still there. Two different things. Does that make sense to whoever asked that question? Yeah? Happy with that answer? Okay. If you want to come back at me, if you have like a subsidiary question, please ask, just raise your hand or whatever. I'm very happy to take like secondary questions if you like. If you don't understand what I'm saying, or if you, you know, whatever, please come back. When one commits suicide in this life, is there a tendency for this person to exhibit the same act again in the next life? How to break the cycle? Thank you. They say that if you commit suicide, it leaves an imprint on the mind, and of course if you've done it once, it's always easy to do it again. It's like a criminal, the first act of crime is always the most difficult one. Once you've done something bad one time, it's like it becomes easy. The mind gets used to that idea of stealing something or of killing somebody. So once you have that imprint in the mind, it's much easier to do it the second time. The hard one is always the first time around. And so yes, it tends to leave an imprint on the mind, so be very careful. Suicide is not normally a very good solution. If you have problems in life, you will have to face those problems afterwards again. Anyway, you come back, the problems are still there, because the problems are mental problems. You know, so if you feel depressed, or you feel, or maybe you have some kind of mental illness like schizophrenia or whatever, suicide is not usually the answer. Usually you come back and you have to face exactly the same thing again. So don't try to avoid that. And of course the way to break the cycle is not to follow that urge. If you have an urge to kill yourself, don't follow it. Don't do that. That's basically all, you know, all there is to breaking the cycle. And if you understand the Dhamma, if you understand that we have to work on these defilements, we are here now, we have the good teachings with us, this is a great opportunity to practice this path. It's a great opportunity to understand the teachings of the Buddha. Take this opportunity. This, now you have it. You don't know. Next time you come back, it may not be there anymore. You have no idea what's going to happen next. Maybe you get reborn in some country where there's no Dhamma, or you go to some realm where there's no Dhamma, and then you are, in a sense, lost in the darkness when there's no proper practice around. But take the opportunity and don't commit suicide. What type of changes we should expect in our daily life after attending a retreat like this? Okay. Well, I think the kind of changes is that one of the most important things of this kind of retreat, there's many, many aspects of this kind of retreat, but one of the beautiful things is that you get a chance to go deeper into the Dhamma, to increase your faith, increase your confidence, increasing your sense that you are a practicing Buddhist, you're doing the good things. So hopefully when you go back home, you go back to your ordinary life again, there's some spark inside of you, some sense that this Dhamma practice is very important, and it's something that you want to integrate into your life. And because of that, you become better at keeping the five precepts, you become better at being kind and compassionate to people around you, you become better at thinking the kind thoughts, thinking good thoughts, and all these kind of things. So it's basically it's that inspiration which you take with you. Even if you just understand the Dhamma talks and you get a deeper understanding of the Buddha's practice, that is maybe the most, that is very important in itself. Now, of course, if your meditation goes well and you get some nice experiences on a retreat like this, that memory of those experiences is also very, very powerful and very important. Because when you think back at that bliss and that happiness that you had on the retreat, it becomes easier to understand why you have to practice properly in ordinary life. Because you can see the connection there between the bliss on the retreat and your practice in ordinary life. You can feel that when you do something which isn't wholesome, even if you think a bad thought, you can feel that it actually leads in the wrong direction. It leads away from the happiness that you experienced on this retreat. Look at the mind when you feel happy. Look at the mind when you feel content. See that the mind is pure, that it is a beautiful state, it's a happy state, it's a sense of, you know, you don't have any anger, any ill will, any negativity, hardly any desire there. And that beautiful state of mind that you have on a retreat like this, or can have on a retreat like this, that is the one which you want to emulate and also have in your daily life as far as possible. So bring back the teachings and bring back also some good memories. Those two things together are very powerful there. Can you please explain the significance of the Katina ceremony that we will be part of on Sunday here? Okay, the Katina ceremony was something that was established at the time of the Buddha. And the monks had lived the reins and the Buddha laid down a ceremony for the basically for the monks who had stayed in one monastery to receive like gifts from the lay supporters of that area who had supported those monks for the 3 months of the rains retreat. And this is exactly the same thing you see now. You see all the monks at Bodhinyana Monastery. The lay community comes together, even those we haven't seen at all for a whole year. At least they come once a year for the Katina ceremony. They come and basically to show the support for the monasteries. It's a time of offering something to the monastic community. In particular, the most important thing to offer is the Katina robe. It's the robe cloth. And at the time of the Buddha, because society in those days was very poor, it was difficult often for the monks and the nuns to get hold of proper robes. It was an opportunity for those monks who practiced well and who gave inspired and gave confidence to the lay community. It was a great chance for them to actually get some good robes that they could use, which might otherwise be very, very difficult for them. These days, you could argue that maybe it's not so important because, you know, these days robes are much more plentiful. But it's still, it's nice. I find it quite nice when you get, you know, at least once a year is probably enough, but you get a large community coming together and everybody is doing something good, doing something nice. I think it's quite inspiring. And it draws in people who often don't come to the monastery here, don't come to the retreat center here. Okay. Yes, sir. Oh, yeah. Yeah, okay. Yeah, that's true. There is the way it works is that the monks decide on a monk they find who is suitable, who needs a robe, and then that the process is that the cloth is given to the Sangha, and then when the cloth is given to the Sangha has to make up a robe before dawn on the following day. So basically you have those, you know, if it's offered in the morning, you have something like, how many hours is it then? 16 hours or something? Or whatever it is, until dawn the following day to make up the robe. And then you have a ceremony where you present that finished robe to one of the in the monastic community. In Thailand, it used to be very, you know, Ajahn Brahm and all the old monks always talk about the old days in Thailand. they were really tough days because, you know, you were given a white piece of cloth and you had to sew it up, you had to dye it, and you had to do all these kind of things, you know. And the dye in those days was jackfruit dye. You had to cut down a jackfruit tree, and then you have to chop it up, and you have to boil the sap out of the wood. Then when the sap was boiled out, you put the cloth in, and then you have to keep turning it all night for it to dry. And then early in the morning sometime, you finish with this process. So it used to be in the old days, it was a very big job. These days, it's actually much easier to do. Okay. My mind is afraid of external contact because it's always scared of disturbance. What should I do? Okay. To some extent it's good. It depends where you're coming from and why you're doing it. But if you have a peaceful mind and you feel that you are at ease and things are going well on the meditation retreat, it's usually a good sign if you don't want too much external contact. It's a good, because it means you're peaceful. You don't want to have too much dealings with other people and all these kind of things. So it's a good thing. So don't feel, that's actually a very, very likely on a retreat like this, it's very likely to be a wholesome state of mind, something positive. But also you have to be careful that sometimes people get into, don't want to have anything to do with others, but it can come from defilement as well. So you know, maybe you're upset or you're angry or you're negative or whatever. And if that is the case, then of course not wanting to disturb might not actually be the right thing. It may come, it depends always where it's coming from. Everything in Buddhism is about why you are doing things. If you're doing it for the right reasons, it's good. If you're doing it for the wrong reasons, it is usually bad. So check your mind state. Understand your motivation. Why are you doing this? So that is always the most important thing. Yeah? And almost anything in Buddhism, anything you do, can be decided depending on your mind state, what the mind state is like. Yeah? Hi Bhante, if we would like to offer Katina robe during Sunday Katina ceremony, how do we go about it? Okay, you take a robe and you come up to the monks and give it to the monks. It's very simple. So usually the way we do things here in the monastery, we have lots and lots of robes at the monastery here. So it's often a very kind of ceremonial thing. So what we often do here, if you don't have a robe to give to the monks, the lay people usually have a table outside, and there's lots of robes there, and then you often give a donation, and they give you a robe, and then you present the robe to the monk. So if you don't have a robe yourself, that is how you get hold of a robe. And then you just follow the procession, and you come into the hall, and you offer the robe to Ajahn Brahm or to whoever is in the hall here. Dear Ajahn B, the word contemplate keeps popping up in Dhamma. What is the exact meaning of the word? Okay, that's the first question. Second question is, sometimes we are taught to let go during meditation, but sometimes we are told to concentrate on our breath, like breathing in, breathing out. I am confused. Okay, yeah, good point. That's a very valid point. So the first question is, what is the exact meaning of the word contemplate in the Dhamma? And usually the word contemplation, English word contemplation, is usually used for like vipassana. Vipassana is often translated with insight, but I think it might be better to actually call it contemplate or clear seeing or something like that. And contemplation in Dhamma is any kind. Vipassana basically means understanding things according to the way they actually are. Now, what is the way things actually are? It is impermanent, it's suffering and non-self. This is like the fundamental aspects, the way the Buddha taught. This is the way the world is. It's marked, if you like, by these three characteristics. Everything is marked by these three characteristics. So when you contemplate in such a way that you are focusing on these three characteristics, impermanence, suffering and non-self, then you are contemplating. That's what contemplation means. And there's many ways you can do contemplation. One of the ways is that you can, for example, you can recollect death, your own death in the future, or the death of somebody else. And death is essentially, recollecting death or thinking about death is a kind of vipassana practice, contemplation practice. When you remember death, you're remembering impermanence of your own body, impermanence of all your belongings, impermanence of all your friends and your family, etc. You're also remembering suffering, because you know that if you are attached to any of these things that are going to be taken away from you, you will suffer as a consequence. So that's how impermanence and suffering go together. And it also helps you with the idea of non-self, because you know that if you are going to die, it means that you are not able to control your body. You cannot say that I will have this body as long as I want, when death comes, it gets taken away from you regardless. You're not in charge. You can't control this. So death is one way of contemplating, is one type of vipassana practice. Or you can just contemplate impermanence more generally, reminding yourself of the impermanence of everything around you. And you can bring that out, basically make the whole universe is essentially impermanent. So everything is impermanent, everything around you is impermanent. When you start thinking about it, it's quite obvious, not that hard to see. And then you understand that if you're attached to any of these things, you will suffer because you're holding on to that which will be taken away from you, and of course, suffering has to arise. And then the deepest aspect is always the non-self aspect. Basically, non-self means you cannot control things. You're not in charge. You cannot say, let things be this way, don't let them be otherwise. You can't do that. You can't say, may I never be depressed, may I always be happy. It doesn't work, because sometimes you are not happy, sometimes you are sad, other times you are happy. Things go up and down. You can't control these things. And that fact that you can't control things, that is the non-self aspect of these teachings. That's what we mean by contemplation, is vipassana practice. And vipassana always goes together with samatha. So if you do vipassana properly, and you find that you are able to contemplate your own death, and because by doing that vipassana, if you really see that something is impermanent, if you really understand that something is suffering, what happens? You let go. Because there's no point in holding on to something which is suffering. So letting go is the result of vipassana. When you let go, you become peaceful. Why? Because desire is abandoned. Holding on to something means you have desire for something. That desire is not a peaceful feeling. It's something which drives you out there, wanting to control the world, wanting to get things this way or that way. By seeing things as suffering and impermanent, understanding that there's no point in holding on to these things, you let go of attachment and desire, and you become peaceful. Then when you become peaceful, you can sit down, you watch the breath, it's so much easier. Then when you become even more peaceful watching the breath, you can do more vipassana again, and your insight will be deeper because you're even more peaceful. So these are two aspects of the same thing. Vipassana makes you peaceful, samatha makes you peaceful. Samatha gives you greater insight because you're more peaceful, and vipassana also gives you greater insight. So they're basically two aspects of the same thing. Okay, that's just a little bit about samatha and vipassana. Yeah, sometimes we are taught to let go during meditation, but sometimes we are taught to concentrate on our breath, like breathing in and breathing out. Yeah, so the point here is that the best kind of breath meditation is not the kind of meditation where you hold on to the breath. Now, if you're holding on, that's what we usually call concentration, right? You concentrate on something, you force your mind onto the object. Now that is the standard way of concentrating, and that is the kind of concentration which makes you tired. It makes you know what it's like if you have some assignment at work, you have to read a particular book, or you have to write a particular paper, or something that you have to do. It's not very nice, so you have to force your mind onto this. After a while, you get tired. And it's exactly the same thing with the breath. If you have to force your mind onto the breath, after a while, you become tired. The mind doesn't like it, and that is precisely why you have to force it in the first place, because you don't like what you're watching. So the ideal way of watching the breath is by just letting go, allowing the mind to become peaceful. And then when the mind becomes peaceful, after a few days of meditation retreat, you find that when you sit down, the breath appears all by itself in your mind. It's just there. You're just quiet, and the breath comes by itself. So there's no force there. There's no kind of concentration in the ordinary sense of the word concentration. It's a natural concentration. It happens just by itself, because it's pleasing, because it's beautiful, because it's a nice sensation. That's why it's happening. And this is the ideal way of doing breath meditation. Sometimes you may find that you may have to use a little bit of maybe will initially to sort of hold your mind onto the breath. But ideally, you use no will at all. You're just there because it just happens all by itself. That's the ideal way of doing meditation practice. So this is how you both let go and you focus at the same time. In fact, the more you let go, the more easy it is to stay with the breath. Okay. Okay, first council, was it bhikkhunis also? Were there bhikkhunis in the first council? Okay. The records that we have of the first council, there, as far as I know, there's no records of there being any bhikkhunis there. Certainly in the Pali canon, there is no record of bhikkhunis being present at the first council. I don't know whether that is because they weren't recorded, they were actually there, but this isn't mentioned, I don't know. But there is no record of that for sure. That okay answer? Was that what you wanted to know? Yeah. Okay. Dear Ajahn, is it possible to vow or ask for a good death? Example, not prolonging sickness or great suffering before one dies. Okay. Yeah. Everything, these kind of things are basically usually a result of karma. So if you have like a long illness before you die, often it's a result of karma. And you just don't know what karma you have in store for yourself. People are very different. Some people have a very easy death. They die straight away. They just go to sleep and then they don't wake up in the morning and that's it. But other people have to go through like sometimes years and years of cancers and all kind of things. And that, of course, can be a lot of suffering before you die. But you can't really vow and ask for these things. You just have to take things as they come. So what you have to do instead is to prepare yourself so that your mind is ready to accept whatever comes. So if you have a good mind, if you have a pure mind, and you have done your practice properly, then when you come, there will be minimum suffering for you, even if you have a difficult death. And that is the thing. If the mind is pure, then the physical body suffering doesn't matter so much. If the mind is impure, and you rely maybe on your happiness, on having a good body, maybe you rely on your happiness through your sensual impressions that you have, then you have a really hard time when you're going to die. So the best strategy is simply to keep practicing the five precepts, keep coming and doing nice retreats, keep doing your meditation, keep purifying your mind. And the more pure you are when you die, the easier your death is going to be, regardless of what happens. It's hard work, isn't it, being a Buddhist? It's not, nothing is just making a vow or asking for anything. You actually have to work for these things. So, but I think it's also realistic. Sometimes if it's too easy, usually means it's not really realistic. Are you happy with that answer? Yeah. Okay. In the driverless bus of our life, similarly, this morning Ajahn Brahm explained that when an attempt is made to find out who is driving the bus through long, deep meditation practices, in that stillness, the knower, the doer, disappears. The bus is in reality driverless. But if the mind has stopped perceiving anything in the stillness, who is perceiving this truth? Is it a trace of mind still aware? Thank you very much. Okay, well, I think the main thing with the driverless bus simile is that the doer has disappeared. Because remember, we're talking about the driverless bus here. Now, a driverless means that nobody's in charge. Nobody is saying, go this way, go that way, go fast, go slower, all these kind of things. So driverless just means, the main point here, is that nobody is ordering the bus around. Nobody is inside of you saying this, do that, and go this way. And the understanding of the driverless bus is the understanding that the will, the chaitana, the thing which the doer inside of you, is a conditioned process. There's no you in there who says, I will do things this way. There's no you who says, I want to do this, I don't want to do that. It is all a conditioned process. And that is an enormous revelation, because most of the time we feel like we decide, I want to do this, I want to go go to this retreat, I want to meditate, I want to be a good Buddhist, I want to see this movie, I want to, whatever it is, we always feel that we are in charge and we want to do things. It's a very powerful force inside of us that sees that. So when you see the driverless bus, you're essentially seeing that there is nobody there who is in charge. It's a completely conditioned process. And that is very, very powerful. So I think that is the main point here, is that the that's what it's all about. Of course, there is also such a thing as the knower as well. The knower is the aspect of knowing. So let's say that you're on board a driverless bus, there's nobody in charge. You can still see things, you can still experience the world around you. And that is a different aspect from the doing aspect. And ultimately, you can see that even the knower aspect is empty. Even the knower aspect, there's nobody actually behind that. There's not a self or a being behind even the knowing. And it is true that even the knowing can disappear completely. There are such, these are very kind of deep states of meditation. There's something called like the cessation of perception and feeling, where everything just stops completely. And the way that you know that these things happen is not because you know that you're in that state. You can't know you're in that state because the mind stops, basically. The way you know is by the process which occurs as you enter the state, and then the process which occurs as you come out. You can see the inclination of mind going towards stopping more and more until it stops. And as you come out, you can see the gradual emergence of perception and mind, and you can deduce from that with certainty that the mind completely stopped in the intermediate period. So that's the driverless bus and the also the cessation of knowing. Does that make sense? Yeah. I'm not sure if it makes sense. It's very these are very, very profound things, but that's. That's what anatta, non-self, means in the final analysis. Yes, at the back there.
What you just said, I think it's very confusing.
Can you say again, please?
Can you see if what you just said makes it more easy to understand?
Understand? Okay. Sometimes you have to study these things for a while to get your head around these things. Sometimes, you know, you actually have to read them again and again, and eventually you get an understanding of this. But what I'm essentially what I'm saying is that think of yourself, whenever you make a choice in life, you all make choices all the time. You decide, I want to do this, I want to do that, I want to go here, I want to travel there. And that choice, it feels inside of you. If you look inside your heart, it feels like you are making choices, right? It feels, I want to go here, I want to go there. But what you actually see in this process, when you have some very deep insight into the nature of the mind, you see that actually it's not you who makes the decisions at all. It's a conditioned process. There are all these things which work on your mind, work on you. This person said that, you heard this on the radio, and you read this in the newspaper, and you had such and such a childhood, and you had such and such a past life. And all these conditions come together. They are what make a particular decision. It's not you. It's not that I inside which make decisions in life. And that is the insight, which is the driverless bus. Life is like a driverless bus. You are like this body is like a bus without a driver. It just wanders around in the world, just like a bus without a driver. There's nobody there steering it. It's all a product of conditions around you. Does that make sense to you? Yeah. That's a driverless bus simile. And the other aspect I was talking about is that once you have seen that the doer, the thing inside it which makes choices and decides either this or that, once you've seen that, the next step is to understand that also the knower, the knowing of things, also is empty of the self. It's like the deepest perception that we have is that I know, I feel, I experience this, I experience nice meditation. Actually, there is no I inside which experiences anything at all. There is just the experience, but there is no experiencer. You see the difference? There's no me which experiences anything, there is just the experience. And this is the other profound insight, what happens, or can happen, you know, when you get into very, very deep meditation. These are very refined things, very, very profound things. But that is what the Buddha said you can experience when you go deep enough. That make sense to you? Sort of. Think about it a little bit, because sometimes these things, you have to give them time to sink in, to understand these things, because they are very profound. Yes? Yeah. Well, this is the thing, is that, you know, even though there is no self, there is still the law of karma. So there may not be a self, but the law of karma still operates. So the point is that even if the self, you can take that out of the equation completely. Yeah. But if you do something bad, the law of karma says you will reap bad results. So it doesn't affect the law of karma. The fact that there's no self there doesn't actually make any difference. So these things work together. The law of karma is one thing. The lack of a self, the lack of an abiding, permanent essence is something else. Think about it. Yes, Daniel. Law of karma, right, okay. Sometimes people do learn, sometimes they don't learn. That's the problem, you know. I mean, you do something bad and you think that if you... Because the problem is that actually understanding the law of karma is actually very hard. It's not something you can just do by watching yourself. And sometimes we get reborn in very bad circumstances, maybe in one life, because we did bad karma in the past life. But because we can't see the connection, we don't really learn anything from that, you know. It's very hard to actually to learn from these kind of things. Why the law of karma is there?
Yeah, how it helps a being to progress along the path to...
Yeah, well, I mean, the law of karma is just that, you know, the kind of practices you do as a Buddhist, the nice thing about them is that if it doesn't take you to enlightenment, if it doesn't take you to the end of samsara, you know that at the very least you're making good karma, so you're making some happiness for yourself in the future. So the law of karma is, in a sense, it's a double protection. It protects you from a bad rebirth, and it also leads you towards enlightenment eventually. So if you have a big store of a good karma, it means that you have a greater chance of experiencing happiness and joy in this life. Because you have a greater chance of experiencing happiness and joy, it means that your meditation will generally be more profound. So by all means, making good karma is important. There is a sutta where the Buddha says to the monks, don't be afraid of making good karma. Don't be afraid of making punya. Punya is another term for good karma, because punya is a term for happiness. So if you create happiness for yourself, you're also creating the cause and conditions for eventually exiting from samsara. So good karma is always a positive thing. It helps you on the path. It moves you in the right direction. Eventually, you have to go beyond karma. And this is what the Buddha talks about in the suttas. He calls it the karma which is neither black nor white and has neither black nor white results. And this is the kind of karma that you create when you become like a stream enter or you become an arya. But this is very high up on the path. It's very, very, very refined things. Is that what you were asking, Daniel? Yeah, sort of. Yeah, okay. Yes, sir. There still is need, and this is the point. This is the thing, because we all have, you know, unless you're enlightened, you have this delusion of self in there. You have the sense that you are in charge, right? I can decide. I want to do good. I want to do bad. So use that delusion to your advantage and say, oh, I can choose. You have a sense that I can choose. So use that delusion and say, okay, I'm going to use that delusion to my advantage by choosing the good things, not the bad things. Whether ultimately you are choosing or not is really irrelevant. You just use that as a means of moving in the right direction. It's very hard for you to tell whether you are deciding what is good because you are a Buddhist, because you heard many nice talks, because you have faith in that, or is it because you are choosing? What is actually more important there? And certainly for me, I look at my life and I feel that, well, one of the main reasons why I'm doing this is because I have a sense of the Buddhist teaching is right. That's why I'm doing it. You start looking into the details, you see that even then you can understand that the conditions around you are probably far, far more important than your own personal choice. Okay, so there's a little bit of personal choice left maybe, for now, and then see what happens as you move down the line and you go further. So pretend, you know, yeah, use that sense of self to your advantage and see what happens. It, Yeah, well, you have to be careful there, and you have to be careful to use this in the right way. Yeah, and that's a very good point. It doesn't mean that there is, because as I said, the law of karma still operates. It's still there. It doesn't matter. So you're still going to reap the results if you do bad things, you know. So the thing is that you have to be, that's the wrong way of looking at it. If you look at that way, you're going to be in trouble. So don't do that. Yeah. Yes, sir. Yeah. Yeah, and this is the profound difficulty with the Buddha's teachings, is to understand that there doesn't need to be a self to experience the results of karma. It's like a process. And the Buddha is described in the suttas as a stream of consciousness. Now that stream of consciousness is just like in this life here, right? If you think about yourself now, and you think about yourself maybe 20 or 30 years ago, now, is that person the same person, or is it a different person? And you would probably say, oh, it's a little bit different, a little bit the same, right? Your body has changed over 30 years, maybe your way of thinking has changed over 30 years. And then exactly the same thing, if you go from one life to the next life, if you can remember the passage from one life to the next one, you will see the evolution of the mind from one life to the next, just as you're seeing the evolution of the mind in this life. It's an evolution, it's a continuous change as you move along. And that stream of consciousness, that is what receives the result of karma in the future. There's no need for a self there. So let's do that. Yeah, you don't even contribute that, because that comes from something as well, you know. So that also comes from something here. You know, your yonisomanasikara is also conditioned. If you have yonisomanasikara, it's because of whatever past conditions as well. So everything is really part. It's true, you're quite right. And that is, you know, you probably maybe heard of Ajahn Brahm. Sometimes he uses this simile that he gives to the monks. And this was something he heard from Ajahn Shah from Thailand. And Ajahn Shah would say, you know, sometimes all you do, you know, all these, I have planted all these mango trees. All you need to do is sit under the mango tree until the mango drops. That's what he said there. And the idea is that the planting of the mango tree is the seed of the Dhamma goes into you because you have heard the teachings or whatever. And eventually the penny drops and you become enlightened. It's just a process basically happening. Yeah. But, you know, you still have to be wise, you still have to be as smart, still make the best of it. If you just go back and sleep all day and sort of lie in bed just waiting for enlightenment, it's not going to happen. Part of that process is putting forth the energy, putting forth the practice, following basically the teachings and the suttas. Yeah. The reason that you make an effort is because you know that effort is going to be helpful to reach enlightenment. That's why you do it. So the Buddha says that effort is useful, effort is helpful. If you don't make the effort, you're not going to get there. So that's why you do it.
But that's only true because you've heard that message.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. That's good enough. Yeah. Yeah.
One little thing, for those skeptics who don't, who obviously aren't taking the Buddhist teachings on hand, science proved that conscious will is an illusion back in the 60s, basically that the brain starts initiating an action and a few milliseconds after the person gets a feeling that they willed it, rather than it started. And there was a book by Daniel Wegner called Illusion of Conscious Will, which sums up all the scientific research. So after reading that, a person is more rational and looking at the experiments based on, you know, probing at the brain, then you can't, you know, deny that. So then you know that. So then you have more faith in the Buddhist teachings than following the path. So Daniel Wegner, Illusion of Conscious Will.
Yeah, I think you're right. There is actually a lot of scientific evidence out there but that the will actually is conditioned. There is the famous experiment about the somebody showing that the moment you actually make a decision, the moment you feel you make a decision, comes after the time when you actually did make a decision. By probing your brain, they could show that the decision happens first, and then comes the feeling that you make a decision afterwards, which is quite interesting. Yeah. Anyway, maybe we should try a few more questions because we're getting stuck here on a few things. These profound things, sometimes you just have to sort of put it to one side and think about it for a while because they're very, very deep. Okay, dear Ajahn, kindly explain right intention. Okay, I thought it is to renounce the world. Does it mean that we all have to become monks and nuns to practice the Eightfold Path? Is Ajahn Brahm's talk about letting go similar to right intention? Thank you. Renunciation, right intention, first of all, as you may know, is the intention of non-ill will, of non-harming, and also of renunciation. And of those two, of course, the initial ones are usually non-ill will and non-harming, having metta, having compassion for the beings around you. And renunciation is a gradual thing. Renunciation doesn't just mean renouncing the world. It's a gradual thing. If you keep the five precepts in daily life, that is a type of renunciation. You're giving up certain things. There are certain things you can't do if you're going to, keep the five precepts. So that is renunciation already. And then when you come on a retreat like this for 9 days, that is a deeper type of renunciation because you're giving up the ability to eat in the afternoon. You are sitting here in meditation many hours a day. You don't have any entertainment. You don't have all your normal things that you would do in ordinary life. So this is also renunciation. And the type of renunciation that you do as a monk or a nun, yes, it's a good step, and of course the Buddha would recommend that if you can do it. But it is not absolutely required. It's not something that one should force oneself to do unless one feels one is ready for it. If you're not ready for it, you become a monk or a nun, and then you end up disrobing after a few years because you can't really, you're not, basically not ready for it. But renunciation in Buddhism, what it really means, is renunciation of the five types of sense pleasure. That's what it really means. So on a retreat like this, the idea is to get into a state of meditation where your mind is so peaceful that you don't have any kind of desire for this or desire for that, particular desire which is related to the five senses. And when you have that, that's when you become very nice and peaceful. So this is a true renunciation of Buddhism, getting rid of the five sense pleasures. And then you have the opportunity to get really deep meditation, to have deep insights and all these kind of things. That is the real meaning of renunciation. So when Ajahn Brahm says letting go, is it similar to right intention? Yes, it is. When Ajahn Brahm talks about letting go, usually he means not having this doer inside which pushes you around this way, pushes you around that way. Now the reason why the doer is so active normally is because you have desire, sense desire. As long as the desire is there, the doer is going to try to seek gratification in those five senses. And the doer will push you around. So the moment you are able to let go of the five sense desires, desire for the five senses, the doer also tends to disappear. So these things tend to go together here. Two aspects of the same thing really here. Okay, so, dear Ajahn Brahmali, Ajahn was sharing his experiences with Lungpur Cha as a junior monk. May we have a little about your experience as an Anagarika with junior monk with Ajahn Brahm as your teacher? Thank you. Okay. I'm not sure what I should say, what I shouldn't say. I think I think you have to be careful to. I don't really like saying too much about my personal experience with Ajahn Brahm because he's still around, he's still alive. It's better to talk about people who are dead. Because sometimes if I say what I think, then, some people say, oh, that's very interesting, other people. And then after a while you think, oh, is he actually right? Why does he think this? Maybe he's just stupid and ignorant. Maybe he doesn't understand properly. The most important thing is for you to decide for yourself what you think. And this is what the Buddha said, that the only really good reason to place faith or confidence in somebody is through your own experience with that person. So you look at Ajahn Brahm and see what you think. Is he a peaceful person? Is he a kind-hearted person? Is he a person with a lot of anger? Is he a person with a lot of ego and all these kind of things? In particular, look at the defilements. Does he have many defilements? And if you find that he doesn't have many defilements, that is where you should place your faith. So trust your own judgment. If whatever I say is really irrelevant, because you can't trust me anyway. How do you? You don't know me. You have no idea if what I say makes any sense. So don't trust what I say. But again, I have to say that my personal experience with Ajahn Brahm is very good. And you can take it that the very fact that I've been living with him for 16 years, I haven't left the monastery, I haven't gone somewhere else, means that I must have a fair amount of confidence in Ajahn Brahm. Otherwise, I wouldn't be here. It's really as simple as that. So that's my perspective. But again, don't trust me. I could be completely deluded. You just don't know her. So look for yourself. Investigate for yourself. Okay, dear Bhante, has Pali always been the language of every past Buddha? Okay, if not, may I just chant in English, since I understand the meaning? Thank you. If you start, Pali has definitely not been the language of every past Buddha. It wasn't even the language of the present Buddha. If you understand the history of Buddhism, you realize that the Pali language is quite close to what the Buddha spoke, but it's not exactly the same as what the Buddha spoke. Pali is like an artificial language which appeared maybe 200 or 300 years after the Buddha. When they started collecting the teachings, they started transforming it into a canon, and they started to make it permanent. That's when it became a permanent language, became known as Pali. In fact, the word Pali is not a name of a language at all. Pali means like text. Pali Bhasa is the language of the text. So Pali it's not even a language originally. These days it's used as if it is a language, but in fact it's not actually a language. So every past Buddha certainly did not speak in Pali. I think that's pretty clear. And yes, I would encourage people to chant in English. If you find a nice chant like the Metta Sutta, whatever that you find is very inspiring and goes to your heart and is something that you can use to make you feel nice and peaceful, make you feel at ease, by all means chant in English. The purpose of chanting is not some kind of magical trick that is going to give you lots of merit or whatever because you chant a lot. The purpose of chanting is basically to either make you understand the Buddha's teachings better, to make you feel nice and peaceful so you can actually do some meditation afterwards. Always think of it in those terms. Do it because it has an effect on you, something positive. It moves you forward in the Dhamma practice. Don't just do these things automatically like some kind of parrot or something. Yeah. Boy, there's so many questions here. Okay, that's good, it's great. This is wonderful. Okay, so next one here. If someone wastes food in the retreat, should I gently remind her that, or is that not my business? Her karma would take care of it. I take care of mine. You have to be, it really depends on the situation. There's never any absolute clear-cut yes or no what is right or wrong. But be careful, because what you may consider a waste, somebody else probably does not consider a waste. You know, it's just different perceptions very often. Because it's different perceptions, if you remind them, they may not agree with you. And then you might get upset because they don't agree with you, etc., etc. So things tend to escalate. So I would say, normally, allow people to do their own thing. They do their thing, you do your thing. People look at things differently, and this is just the way this world actually is. But then again, maybe there is a situation when somebody isn't aware what is going on, they don't really understand the situation or whatever. And if that is the case, they might be happy to get your kind of, you know, gentle nudge. You know, but look at this, you can do it this way instead. And maybe they're happy. But I think 95% of the time, at least, it's better not to say anything. Be very, very careful. Look into your heart. Are you coming from compassion? Are you coming from metta? Is there any kind of ill will there? If there's even a tiny bit of ill will, don't do it. If you are kind of fault finding with somebody else, don't do it. If you're coming from metta, then maybe you can do it. So be careful with these kind of things. What should one do after getting nimittas? Okay, wow. Okay, I'm not sure exactly the meaning here. Does it mean after coming out of the meditation, or presumably later? Usually, nimittas is like, you know, if we listen to Ajahn Brahm's teaching here, it is a stage that you get just before jhana stages, basically. So if you get nimittas, it's great, it's wonderful. You're doing a really, really good job in your meditation practice. And it means that from there you can move on and you can develop this nimitta into the jhanas. So it just means keeping going, keeping practicing those nimittas until you become so peaceful that it actually makes you enter the jhanas. But you will find that if you do get the nimitta, you will feel very peaceful afterwards, and you will want to be by yourself, and you will want to be secluded. You don't want to really have much contact with other people. It becomes something very peaceful and very nice. So there is, it's just part of the meditation experience. There's nothing else to do than the ordinary thing, and just guard that peace. That next time you sit down, again, you get the same peace coming back again. So guard it by being careful and not wasting that peace by chatting or by doing things which are unconducive to peace. The Buddha mentioned that anapanasati can fulfill the four satipatthanas. Can the same be said of metta? Normally, I think the answer to that is the suttas do not say that metta fulfills the four satipatthanas. It is only said about anapanasati, about watching the breath. Usually, metta, it does not normally involve any kind of contemplation or insight, whereas the breath meditation can involve insight and contemplation. So because of that, metta is usually considered what we call a samatha object, which makes you peaceful. It makes you feel very good. It makes you become a very good person, very pure-hearted person. And for that reason, it is great and it's very useful as part of practicing the path. But when you come out of that metta meditation, usually you have to do some more work, vipassana work afterwards. That could be breath meditation or just contemplating, impermanence and non-self and suffering and these kind of things. So the answer is basically no. Metta meditation is a practice which brings you wonderful results, and it's a very important part of the path, but it can only take you so far normally. Happy with that? Can a psychic master provide past life reading services just by name and birth date? Don't know. Maybe, yeah. I'm always very skeptical about these kind of things. Usually these kind of psychic masters, they are usually very clever people who are able to get information out of you in very subtle ways. And I think 99% of the time that's what's happening. And whether this actually is potentially possible, don't know. I never heard of anybody which I would trust, at least. In Buddhism, does such psychic readings, are they valid or exist? I think the Buddha would sometimes maybe, he might, one of the fascinating things in the suttas is that the Buddha never, very, very rarely predicts the future. I think one of the things that you see in the sutta, the only thing that I can remember offhand is what the Buddha says, that Venerable Ananda will become enlightened before he passes away. That is one of the things I remember from one of his few predictions. There are also some other predictions which I take to be a little bit dodgy, which I think maybe the Buddha didn't say. But that is one of the few ones. And generally speaking, the Buddha didn't make any predictions, didn't say anything about the future. And I think that is a good advice and a good thing to stand by. Always be skeptical about people who know the future. That's the way I tend to look at it. Certainly, it's not something that you find that the Buddha mentioned as something that should be done, or that he, said was important, or anything like that. So I would just put that to one side. Dear Bhante, if the husband has lots of sexual thoughts and wants, how to help him reduce them? Okay. Basically, I think one of the things in life is that don't try to change other people. The reason why we often want to change other people is because we think it's easier to change others than change ourselves. We always look outside, we look out there, and we see this person isn't doing the right thing. If they just did the right thing, my life would become so much easier. In fact, it's not like that. Your life doesn't become easier by controlling other people. Your life becomes easy by changing yourself. So don't worry about your husband. I mean, your husband has his own life, and the best thing to do is just to get him on the spiritual path and do the right practice and get him moving in the right direction, and then things will go in the right way. But look after yourself, first of all. My experience is that it is virtually impossible to change other people. It's difficult enough to change ourselves. So try to work on yourself rather than working on others. That is where the real work is. And if you have success with working on yourself and you change, then the people around you will also be affected in a positive way by your own change. So look at yourself. I think this is the kind of the bottom line. And don't worry too much about other people. I can see that in monastic life. One of the beautiful things about having a teacher like Ajahn Brahm is that he lets go so much. He doesn't control other people at all. Even in the monastery, the monks can do pretty much what they want. He gives you a teaching every Wednesday, and he knows that teaching eventually will bring results because people will listen to it, and they will practice accordingly, and it goes into the heart. And finally, ultimately, the mango drops from that tree here. It may take a while, but eventually it drops. And he doesn't control people at all. He does his own practice, he does what is right, and he leaves other people to themselves. And that is, I think, is the right way of doing things. And that is what I try to do in my life as well. I try not to, control the monks around me too much. Sometimes it's difficult when you have your own defilements. Sometimes you get a bit upset and you think, oh, they shouldn't be doing that. But most of the time, I also try to follow Ajahn Brahm's good example. And you try the same. Dear Ajahn, talking about letting go, forget about letting go of husbands, wives, girlfriends, mistresses, how about letting go of the water bottle in the meditation hall? You get good meditation karma from not disturbing others, and the most important thing is you don't disturb yourself. I'm pretty sure one cannot bring water bottles into jhana. Okay, so somebody here is saying, can we please have people not maybe drink so much water in the meditation hall, probably what they're saying here. Yeah, be kind to others, think about the people around you, and try to be as quiet as possible if you can. There's always some people around here who might get nice meditation. You never know, you might disturb somebody. So take that into account. Have a sense of compassion for the people. Make it into a beautiful thing, like an offering to the people around you. When you make these things into an offering, it becomes your good karma as well. And then not drinking water in the meditation hall becomes something beautiful rather than something which you feel is oppressive. So look at it as good karma, as something which is nice. Yes?
Ajahn, may I humbly offer my opinion over this issue?
Okay, yeah.
I think meditation hall is a very, drinking water, you unscrew the
Yeah.
And sometimes you learn the key, I mean, other people try to struggle
Okay.
We are not enlightened. We still have lots of defilement. We do easily
disturbed.
Easily to get ill will.
Yeah.
How should I say? Stimulate by this kind of action. Because we are not.
Sure, yeah. Okay, good. Well, thank you for your comment. And I think it's good if everybody takes into account everybody else, and we look after each other, and we're kind to each other, and all that. It's very important. But also, remember that in a group like this, there's always going to be disturbances. It's impossible not to have disturbances. Remember that. You should also think about these other people, that they might be, they're different from you, they have a different conditioning from you, a different understanding. And try to try to have compassion. Try to think, okay, this is the way they are. This is the way they probably have to do things. We can remind them, but all you can do is remind them. And if they still do it, which may very well happen, you don't know whether this is going to work or not, but try to have compassion, try to have understanding. And this is your chance to sort of overcome any kind of irritation that you have or whatever. So see it as, it's good to remind people, but at the same time, see it as your opportunity also to overcome your own defilements. Okay? Yeah. Yes, you talk. Okay.
I was having a very wonderful meditation, and suddenly I heard a man walk in and he just keep dancing and ding. And then he walked towards the Buddha and he started, "Namo Arahato."
Okay.
It was so funny. I opened my eyes and looked, who was that? And after he walked out, all of us were just bursting into laughter.
Okay.
So,
Good. Good. This thing that funny the first time, the second time is not so funny anymore. Yeah. So you have it. Yeah. Sylvester, you want There's always lots of skillful ways of thinking about using your just use your mind and think. I mean, you are most people here are very intelligent people. Sometimes all you have to do is just to find a method, a way of thinking about things, which and many ways of doing it. I mean, one of my favorite contemplations is just to remind myself that I can't control the world. I'm not going to be able to control anything. I can't control the people around me. I can't control anything basically. People are the way they are. If you think that you are going to go out there and change people's behavior, you're not. That is just delusion. So you have only one choice, and that is to accept things as they are. Now make that a strong perception in yourself. If you make that perception very strong, you find it so much easier to let go. This is the kind of thing you can use. And ultimately, keep practicing metta, and that metta will of course also be a very, very powerful way of overcoming these things. So it's a mixture of things, a mixture of non-self, metta, and et cetera, and you bring it all together, using skillful means. Yes?
I totally agree with you when you said you cannot change people, you have to change yourself.
Yeah.
So I suggest that the next time a person is disturbed, they should bring their own earplugs.
Yeah. Good.
So after that kind of meditation was quite disturbing. So what I do is that I created metta to the meditation using the that piece. Yeah, after that become more peaceful, and my next meditation actually become better than before.
Good. Yeah. Yes.
Can I share one thing? Just now the lady was saying about religious things. In Asia, I think most Asian people when they're young, they actually are trained that in religious place you must be very respectful. This is our text. I mean, it's Asian. So maybe there's a different perception in European.
That's very good. It's a very good point. Yeah. Thank you for that point. Yeah, I think it's a very important point. And this has to do with compassion and understanding that people are different. People come from different backgrounds. People don't necessarily do things because they are ungrateful or because of this. It's just a different conditioning, a different background which does these things. So it's a twofold thing. On the one hand, we have to try to understand that people are different from us. On the other hand, we have to try to be sensitive to the people around us and be nice and kind as we possibly can. So it goes both ways. And both things are important. Okay, it's getting late. I'll do a few more questions in here. Can we go to 9:30? Does that make sense? Yeah? Is it? Okay, so we'll go to 9:30. Yeah. Okay, dear Ajahn Brahmali, what motivated you to become a monk? Okay, I've heard this question a few times before. How did you decide who your teacher should be? Okay, I think this thing about becoming a monk is very strange how these things work. Sometimes I don't really know exactly how it happened. It's just somehow you're attracted to the Buddha's teachings and you think, yeah, okay, I'll go to the monastery for a while and see what it's like. And then you just decide that you want to stay in the monastery because you like the place, you think it's right. I remember I wasn't very sure myself whether I wanted to become a monk or not. So I said to Ajahn Brahm, I'm not really sure about this. So is it okay if I ordain and just stay for a monk for a year? Is that okay? And he said, yes, okay, that's fine. You know, if you want to stay for 1 year, that's okay. And then gradually from that, it just took off more and more. And you eventually find yourself being a monk for 15 years. But the thing is that what really, for me, is the most important thing is just always has been is the fact that this, you know, you have faith in the teachings of the Buddha. You have faith that this is the path to overcome suffering, to find happiness in the world. And you have a deep appreciation of things like rebirth. If you understand rebirth and you understand the potential for suffering by going on and on and on almost endlessly into the future, then it becomes a very important thing to make an end of this. And because of that, that is, I think, one of the main foundational things for taking this path incredibly seriously when you understand rebirth, because that is, in the end, the really scary thing. If there's no self inside of you, if there's nobody here to guide you, to make sure that you always do what is good, you always do what is right, you are just a product of conditions around you, it means that eventually you will be doing bad things, you will be doing stupid things, which will lead you to a bad rebirth in the future. So there is this, you know, the sense, the danger there is very, very great. And for that, the path becomes very important. And for me, that is basically the reason why I'm a monk now, because I think this is the only thing for me that makes any sense to me to do in life. In the beginning, I wasn't so sure. How did you decide who your teacher should be? Okay, basically, I was living in England at the time, and the monastery is in England, and I didn't really know whether I wanted to be there or not. And then I heard a talk by Ajahn Brahm, and I thought to myself, that's my teacher, and I came to Australia, and I've been here ever since. That's how I decided how my teacher was going to be. And then I started studying the suttas of the Buddha, and I tried to find out whether the teachings of Ajahn Brahm actually accord with those suttas. And I think this is one of the most important things. You have to have some kind of neutral ground that you can go to and ask, well, you know, is whatever you want to do in life, you have to have some kind of judge which judges for you and tells you whether something is right or not. And in Buddhism, that neutral judge, that neutral ground is the suttas. And everything goes from there. So if you want to find out whether a teacher is enlightened, if you want to find out whether somebody is teaching the right thing, if you want to find out what is right and wrong, ultimately has to be the word of the Buddha, which is your final ground of appeal. And it's only when I felt that Ajahn Brahm was teaching according to the word of the Buddha, the more you feel that, the greater your confidence becomes. We have two sons, aged 9 and 13. How to teach them meditation? How to encourage them to sit regularly for meditation? Ooh. That's a very good one. I think you have to be careful with young people, forcing them too much to do things. Basically, these things have to come as naturally as possible. So make the Dhamma available to them if they want to go and hear a talk or they want to read something nice about Dhamma, maybe some of the funny stories about Ajahn Brahm or something. Maybe you can read some of those stories at bedtime. Slowly condition them in the right direction by giving them the chance to hear the Dhamma. If they are mature enough, when they become old enough and they are able to decide for themselves, if they have the teachings available, they will be able to see that these are the right teachings. It may be that your children don't have that ability. Maybe your children are very different from you. Maybe they're inclined towards something, just a hedonistic lifestyle, just having fun, just partying, all these kind of things. Sometimes there's nothing you can do about that. So you have to basically accept that your children are not yours. You can't force them to do this. You can't force them to do that. You have to accept them for who they are. If they become Buddhists, great. If they don't, you're going to have to accept that that's the case. So I would say that when somebody is 9 and 13, it's probably too early to start meditation unless they are interested, unless they say, "Oh, can I come along?" Or, you know, or you ask them, "Do you want to come along?" And they say yes. Be very careful, though, because sometimes if you push too much, you create aversion towards Buddhism in the young person rather than actually an appreciation of the teachings. And I think that is the most important thing as a Buddhist monk as well. What you want to do is not, we don't do missionary work as monks. We don't go out and sort of try to convert people. What we do, what someone like Ajahn Brahm does, he makes the Dhamma available in the world. He puts it out on the internet. He goes and gives talks here and there. And when the Dhamma is available, people can have access to it and they can hear these good teachings. And then, if they understand it, if they feel inspired, they become Buddhists and then they practice accordingly. And that's the kind of Buddhist we want to have in the world. You want to have somebody who is convinced that these teachings are right. Because if you have that conviction in your heart that these teachings are right, if you come to these teachings of your own free will, your own choice, disregarding the fact that there is no free will, we just talked about before, if you come from it from your own free choice, it means you're going to be a good Buddhist. If you come to it because you are coerced, you feel coerced or whatever, you're not going to be a particularly good Buddhist. And the only Buddhist that is worthwhile is the good Buddhist who practices properly. There's no point in having, you know, accounting, oh, there's so many million Buddhists in the world. The vast majority of people who call themselves Buddhists are Buddhist in name only, just like most Christians and most Muslims or whatever. Not really Buddhist at all. Buddhist means practicing. It means believing in this teaching, that they actually work. That's what Buddhism means. Not the kind of Buddhist you want. Sorry about that. Probably that, not very happy with that answer, but that's my answer anyway. Okay, is there any dietary restriction in Buddhism or required to follow to get enlightened? The only dietary restriction is to avoid alcohol. So that is the one. Otherwise, of course, often the thing that comes up is the thing about eating meat. Should one be vegetarian or not? The Buddha said that for the monks and the nuns, you cannot eat any meat if it has been killed. The animal has been killed specifically for you. That's the only time you cannot actually eat any meat. And for lay people, I would say that it's up to you. I have a lot of respect for people who want to become vegetarian and want to live a vegetarian life. So if you feel that that's how you incline and you feel that is a compassionate thing to do for animals, I think great. And I would encourage you to do so if you think in that way. If you really find it very hard to give up meat and that sort of thing, and it is okay to eat meat as long as you avoid killing animals, because it is the act of killing itself which creates bad karma. It is that intention that you have at that moment when you kill which is the bad thing. Eating meat, whether it's bad karma or not, I don't know, but the very fact that the Buddha didn't lay it down as a rule means that it cannot be that important. So it is basically up to you. Yes, sir. Good. No, I think that's a very good point, actually. So you are, in a sense, you are promoting the industry by eating meat. Yeah, true. Going back home now, should I practice this meditation? How much time should I spend every day for meditation practice? Again, you have to remember that when you are on retreat like this, it's a very special situation. And it means that the kind of meditation that you can get on this sort of retreat, you cannot expect to have in daily life. So I say in daily life, use meditation in such a way that it promotes your virtue, it promotes your kindness, it promotes your keeping the five precepts. Because this is, as long as you can be a kind and good-hearted person in daily life, that will mean that you are growing in wholesome states. And next time you come back on a meditation retreat, you find that it goes much better next time around. So use your meditation in such a way that it promotes you being kind and a good person. So, and there's many ways of doing that. Spend maybe a little bit of time every day to do a little bit of metta meditation. Wish all the beings around you, particularly the people close to you, wish them well, wish them happiness. And try to purify yourself from any anger and negativity, which then gives rise to breaking the precepts. Or you can just do a peaceful meditation. If you find that the peaceful meditation has the same effect, it makes you become nice and calm and peaceful, and for that reason you actually, it's easy for you to keep the precepts, then do just a peaceful meditation instead. But that is my recommendation. It doesn't matter how much you do. It is really up to you and what you have time to do. Find out how much time you have. Find out how much it actually works. Don't force yourself to sit for half an hour every day if it becomes painful or becomes difficult. Don't force yourself to sit an hour every day if it's hard. Do whatever works. But if you can do at least a little bit every day, just to keep going the sense that you're meditating and also building up the wholesome qualities, that is great. There is never any this is the right way, that is the wrong way. It all depends on the results that it gives. One of the things that I always found very, very useful in the suttas is the Buddha gave some recommendations as to how to make choices in life. How do we choose either to do this or to do that, to meditate a lot, to meditate little? How do we choose what friends to have, what friends not to have, where to live, what religion to follow, all these kind of things. And he's always said, and you find this in many, many suttas, that whatever leads to the increase in wholesome qualities in you and a decrease in unwholesome qualities, that is what you should be doing. Whatever leads to the increase in unwholesome and decrease in the wholesome, that you should avoid. It's a very, very powerful teaching because it's applicable to almost anything in life. So use that. If the Buddha said that that is the way to think, then use that reflection in your own life. Look at your meditation practice. What is giving rise to the best results? And then adjust yourself accordingly and see how you go. One last question. Dear Ajahn, I am to believe that I'm supposed to be mindful of my thoughts. Is it possible to watch a thought arise, progress, and cease? Isn't the thought a process of the mind? So how can the mind watch the mind? Yes, it is possible to see that, because it is just like you are aware of the fact that you have a feeling. You can feel anger. Well, anger is there, and you can also be aware of it at the same time, right? You know you're angry, or you know that you have a desire. You know it's there. So that knowledge is something that can happen simultaneously or straight after the thinking happens. It's so close together, it seems like it is simultaneous. And in fact, if you read again the suttas, the word of the Buddha, he said that this is one of the kind of highest kind of mindfulness, is the ability to see feeling, perceptions and thoughts arise, remain, and then pass away. So if you can do that, it's a wonderful thing. And it's not very easy at all. It takes a very, very deep kind of mindfulness and meditation practice. But it is possible to see that, yes. Any more questions before I call it a day? Yes. Well, you remember that these things all go together. So because metta overcomes the hindrances, and you have to overcome the hindrances to be able to have insight, it sort of works together. So use the metta meditation to help you become peaceful and have no hindrances. And then when you have no hindrances, you can turn your mind to insight afterwards. But the actual metta meditation itself is not really an insight meditation. It's about, you know, purifying the mind, basically. It's a process. It's part of the path. And it's a very important part of the path. But you have to go beyond that eventually. But you can go a long, long, long way just doing metta meditation. Anybody else? Everybody happy? Yeah? Okay. Good. So, okay. I wish you all well. Okay, let's just pay respects to Buddha Mahasangha.